Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Cathy Thomas. Cathy Thomas grew up in southwest of England and Guernsey. She now lives in London. Her short fiction has appeared in publications including The Stinging Fly, Banshee, and Litro. She has an MA in playwriting and was selected for the 2014-2015 Gerwood Arvon Mentoring Scheme as a dramatist. Welcome to Our Shelves, Cathy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I'm delighted to begin by talking about your debut, Islanders, which is published by Virago next month. Now, this is a collection of linked stories covering a period of 20 years in the lives of a group of intertwined people on the island of Guernsey. And I have to say, I really, really enjoyed this book. Not only is the writing excellent, and you managed to inhabit an impressive number of different people, and they're all really quite different characters in what's also quite a nicely short book, let's put it that way. Everyone likes around about 200 pages, I think. But it's also, I think, a real masterclass in what a collection of linked stories can be like and should be like if they're done well. Sometimes I feel like the idea of a linked story collection is a bit of a, you know, it's just a kind of, just a little bit of an edge to kind of, you know, try and make them kind of cohere together. But because you've chosen Guernsey, this particular island, as your setting, and you really have, I think you show very kind of cleverly throughout these stories that actually it is such a small island that these lives really are linked, and they really do linger. Like the people, everyone knows each other in a way that even if you're not best friends with somebody, you've got some sort of history with them going back.
Very much so, yeah.
Right. I'd love to know what sort of, you know, what came first? Did you think, you know, I want to write a story about these people, and is this the way to do it? How did you sort of come up with the germ of the idea for this book?
It's a really good question. So I suppose there are kind of two angles to it. On the first hand, as a reader, I loved reading Link Connections, and I love A Visit from the Goon Squad. I love The Shore by Sarah Taylor, The Lucky Ones by Julianne Pacheco, Olive Kitteridge. There's lots of novels and stories in Link Connections, which as a reader, I really enjoy. I think I love that kind of magic of being able to join the dots. I think all the
yes.
different kind of seeds that writers have set out, and you're able to kind of work between them yourselves as a reader and make those connections. I think it's a really rewarding reading experience, which makes it sound very sort of educational, but I just really, really kind of enjoy it. So on the one hand, that's something that I really take pleasure in. And then on the other hand, I think growing up in Guernsey, I kind of felt that it wasn't something, it wasn't a... The Channel Islands, I don't think, have been hugely well represented on the page, I think, until now. Interestingly, coincidentally, there's a novel and stories is also coming out this year to show what a small place it is. The author of that, Ben Hinshaw, his dad was one of my teachers. So that's kind of gives you an insight into what a small community it really is.
I love it.
I know, it's really lovely. Yeah, Guernsey, it's the setting of one of Victor Hugo's novels, The Toilers of the Sea, because he was exiled there. It's the setting of, there's a novel called The Book of Ebenezer LePage. It's quite a sprawling novel about the history of someone's whole life set on the island. And there's obviously the Guernsey Literary Potato Papaya Society, which is a very different type of novel, I think, to the book that I've written. But I was really interested in trying to bring some sort of sense of island life and that sort of small community living onto the page in a way that hopefully feels a bit more realistic and I know gritty is a word that I think has been used quite a lot in terms of describing the collection, but I think I also enjoy, as a reader, I really enjoy those quite gritty, realist stories by writers like Colin Barrett or Thomas Morris. And so I was also sort of interested in approaching that, but perhaps with a bit more of a female eye, maybe, because I think in the collection, a lot more of the stories are weighted more towards female experience, even though, as you say, Lucy, and very kindly so, I think there is hopefully a real range of characters in terms of ages and backgrounds and gender on the page as well.
Yeah, I love that point you make as well about, as a reader, you love being able to find those little points of connection in these story collections. And I think I'm exactly the same. I love that but I think it's those story collections, the linked ones that really work for me, they make you work a little bit for it. You know, it's also something a little bit more than just saying this character appeared in this story and now they're going to be they're the main character in this story and now they're the secondary character in this story. And when you can kind of pinpoint them in a much more, I suppose, a clever way and make yourself sort of feel clever for noticing these things. Mm. I'm interested to know then, as a writer, when you came to write these stories, were you doing a lot of sort of pre-mapping out in advance about where people would pop up again or crop up in other people's stories? Or how did it sort of come into being? How did it, the evolution of it on the page?
I think I probably should have done more planning. In hindsight, I do feel like I set myself a bit of a challenge, I think, particularly for a first book. So many characters and over such a stretch of time as well. So in terms of how I started it, initially, I didn't necessarily start out to think, oh, I really want to sit down and I really want to write a book about Guernsey. I just started writing some stories, and I have been doing some writing for theatre, which is also another area. Mm. You know, I used to work in the theatre industry. I've always been very interested in playwriting, and I've done bits and pieces here and there. And I had actually been working on a play about Guernsey as well, which is partly why some of the characters sort of came from that. And I felt that form wasn't working, but I thought about using it in a different way. And I do think that there is something in terms of theatre, not exclusively. You obviously get a lot of plays that are set, you know, all in one location over one night or things like that. But you also do get plays that really span time across a character's life in quite an interesting way. And so when I started writing the stories that became the collection, I started with a couple of the stories, so Daily Specials, which is the one set in Fish and Chip Shop, that was kind of one of the first ones, and then Good for a Laugh, which is the first story in the collection as well. Those are some of the kind of early ones, and there's a story that's set on Hen Night as well in Jersey, one of the rival islands, that kind of is the setting for one of the others as well. And initially I was working on the stories, and I think more about a sense of place as well as the characters, rather than explicitly thinking I want these all to link up in this certain way. And then when I started thinking about how could I make them linked in the way that I really enjoy linked collections, I started thinking one point quite specifically about place. Could it be that they all take place in different geographic locations around the island, and how could I make that linked, which is to a degree how they span out. Like, I think they all do take place roughly in different sort of, you know, ones in St. Peterport, ones at the airport, ones around a certain beach, and ones in different bays and things like that. But I was looking at that, and then I was then at one point thinking, could I make all of the different stories happen simultaneously as well? So I was thinking, oh, is there one event and all the different stories happen at one time? And actually then what I really realised was, I think as a reader and maybe as a writer, I'm really obsessed with the idea about whether people change. And I think actually having stories that show a group of characters over a long period of time was a way to explore that. And again, I think as a reader, that's something that I have really enjoyed in, I don't know if you've read The Shore by Sarah Taylor. It's a linked collection of stories, or I think it might be a novel in stories. It's one or the other, but it takes place, I think, over about 200 years, and it dots back and forth in time in a way that is really, it's really imaginative and it's really singular. And I really love that, when you're kind of piecing together and trying to work out, oh, so that's what happened, but also that made that impact on that person's life in that certain way. And so I was thinking about how to do that. And again, I mean, at the moment, now in the form that Island is currently is, the stories are in chronological order. At one point they weren't. So in terms of planning and mapping out, I think I should have done more. I think I set quite a hard task for myself, and definitely, you know, characters' ages, locations, dates, all that kind of stuff changed as it went along. And there was I've got a notebook here, there's various sort of charts in it that I had to keep track of ages and, you know, who was 17 in 2001 and what were they, with, you know, all these different kinds of things. So I ended up, I think, creating more work after the fact, but I think perhaps if I had set out to write it in the form that it was at the beginning, that might not have felt quite so sort of exciting or organic, I suppose, in terms of the ideas that came out of it.
Well, yeah, I think one of the things that I really loved about it was that sense you capture of time passing and of people changing, and also of not changing, and of, like, you know, the idea that some people are sort of trapped in a certain destiny and others have sort of, you know, made changes for themselves, and there was a real I don't know, some of the chapters, I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, you felt a real sort of, I don't know, I felt a real sort of emotional tug for realizing that, oh, this is what that character's grown up to be like. This is their adult life, or, you know, these, I don't know. It's, anyway, it's very moving. I think it's beautifully written, and I urge all our listeners to go out and buy yourselves a copy when it's ready. Pre-order it in advance. So there we are. Right, let's get on to our main questions now, if we may, Kathy. First up, I'm going to ask you to tell me about a book that you are currently reading, or currently on your bedside table about to be read. What have you chosen?
I've chosen We Were Young by Neve Campbell. I don't know if you've read it, Lucy, and I don't know if you read her first novel, This Happy.
I read the first one, but I haven't read the second one yet, so I want the rundown from you on what it's like.
I absolutely loved it. So I read This Happy, I think, did that come out in 2020, which Neve Campbell's first novel, which sort of flits back and forth in time between a woman, I think in her late 20s, who's about to get engaged to someone working in Dublin local politics and is in this kind of quite serious committed relationship, and she has an encounter with someone that she had an affair with who's a married man in her youth, and it's a very kind of claustrophobic, quite drab novel in the best of way. There's something that almost feels quite sort of grey and green about it.
Like drab being used as a positive is a nice way to be.
No, I like it. Yeah. There's something very kind of not seedy, but there's something that feels kind of quite grubby and a bit sad about the kind of setting of it. But I think like Neve Campbell has handled it in a really deft way. And in We Were Young, it's in some ways it's sort of some similar themes, but again, very different story and handled very differently. It follows Cormac, who's a photographer in his late 30s. He teaches at the university, and he is quite unsettled in his life, and he's sort of having affairs with men and women and with people who are his students, and there's a sort of sense of he's not very anchored in what he's doing. And I think what Neve Campbell is really brilliant at is that she's very precise at describing very ambiguous emotions. And I think there's a real sort of gorgeous sense of empathy, I think, in her writing. Like, you could take a character like Cormac that she's describing, and you could perhaps take quite a judgmental eye in a certain way about the way he behaves around some of its characters. And that's not apparent at all in the book. It's a really sort of generous sense of trying to understand this character who is hurting other people in lots of different ways. And there's a content thread that's, there's a storyline in which follows his older brother, who's having a bit of a midlife crisis and is kind of treating his marriage with very little respect. And there's also a line which follows the death of his other brother when he was young, which is a question. Actually, I won't reveal too much. No spoilers from me on this one. But it looks at family in a really knotty way, and it looks at how individual relationships, what impact they have on other people, and how however much you internalize something, if you're going to hurt someone, you're going to hurt someone. But at the same time, it's just handled in a really deft, really empathetic kind of approach. And I won't give away anything, but I've just finished it actually. And the ending of it, there is such a switch for it, which I did not see coming in this really cleverly handled way. So much so that when you're reading it, you want to keep going back and read it. Be like, how did she do it? How did she make it work? Because it's really, really beautiful. So I'd really recommend it.
Okay, it sounds like I have to go and read it now. I think I've got a proof or a copy knocking about somewhere, so I'll find that. It's quite a recent book. I'm interested to find out whether, are you sort of, as you ramp up to sort of publication, are you doing a lot of reading of other people's work that's being published around this time? Or what is your normal kind of reading? How does it sort of pan out? What do you pick? Kind of old books, new books?
Kind of all over the place, which is not very helpful.
No, no, that's always the best kind, I think, really.
I think I probably am quite influenced in terms of I think if there's an author whose work I really love and have enjoyed other writing by them. So like I said, I really enjoyed This Happy. So We Were Young was on my list. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I really loved Wendy Erskine's first collection of short stories. So I went out and bought a second as soon as it came out. And the same Louise Kennedy's novel, which is also another book that I've got next on the list, because again, I loved her first short story collection. So I think I am led slightly by authors, but equally at the moment I must admit I used to have a very monogamous approach to reading. I would read one book at a time and that would be all that I would read, and then now I seem to read all sorts of things at once, and I always have a novel and I always have some non-fiction on the go. So I'm quite a big fan of history writing, I suppose, and memoir as well. So there's normally at least one sort of history book, one novel, one maybe a short story collection, and one something else on the go, but it does vary. And one of the other books I picked up at the moment is a book by Maupassant. So it's a classic. So it really, really kind of varies, I think, between mood. And actually, I do think I am someone who I really try and steer clear of books that perhaps are touching on themes of something that I'm interested in writing, in case it sort of spooks me away from them. So there's a bit by someone else at the moment, actually, which I'd love to read and is on the shelf, but I'm putting it aside for the time being until I finish what I'm doing.
And do you find that when you're kind of really deep in writing that you try and steer clear even more of other fiction in case it infiltrates? I'm fascinated, always really fascinated to find out, because some authors seem to be very strict about not reading other work while they're writing, and other people seem to say no, the more the merrier, you know, all these influences come in.
But I definitely will read fiction, I think, because it shows you how it works. It's what I really find, like, and I think it's, but what I might do is I might read fiction that's on a different topic to an idea that I'm trying to explore, or perhaps tonally is different as well. But I do find that I can be quite even when I remember when I was a teenager and I started writing and I was getting into writing, I'd read one novel by someone and then you desperately want to write in that style. And I really do try and I do try and be really cautious about not taking something that I think will have a real kind of influential effect. But I certainly think, I don't steer clear of fiction at all. But I think more kind of certain topics or things like that that I might steer clear of, just because I think you always get that panic moment when you're writing something that, oh no, someone has already done this and they've done it better. And so I think anything that might feel in that area, my sense is I think it's always better to try and get the writing done. And then at the end of it, you read it and then you read the piece of work and you're like, oh, that's, you know, then you can put it aside. But I think better to, you know, keep a slightly blinkered approach at times if it means finishing a project.
Excellent advice. Right, next up, I think you're going to tell me about an essay that you read that's made you think. What's this essay? Who's it by?
So The Stinging Fly, which is a brilliant literary journal based in Dublin, they recently ran a series of online events. I must admit, I didn't attend the events, but they were based on around the theme of resilience. And they've published an essay by Olivia Fitzsimmons called Notes on Resilience, which is online, so it's free for anyone to read, which is a write-up essentially of some of her thoughts I believe she delivered in the talk. And I would recommend anyone read it. Really, it's a really, really generous, empathetic essay. And it is about rejection. On the one hand, it's very much about rejection as a writer and how do you cope with that? Because it is really baked into the process, whether you've got a book out or you've had five books out or you're still at the start or you're trying to get your first story published, there will be rejection at every single step of the way. And she kind of talks about this in a really, really wonderful, very open, quite sort of heart on her sleeve kind of way, but I think in a way that I think will bring comfort to quite a lot of people. Certainly I found it did. And at the same time, she also talks about parenthood, and she talks about her experience of being a mother, and which I can't speak to, I don't have children, but certainly I think what is really brilliant in the essay, she talks about the simultaneous experiences that you have, where you can have one thing happening on your life and at the same time you can have something that is kind of burbling away in the back of your mind, or and how do you match up these different experiences that are happening. And I think specifically she's talking about parenting, she's talking about one of her son's experiences with reading and how she's trying to kind of progress that, and some comments she's had from the school. And also the essay is so wonderful because also at the end of the essay there's a footnote when she talks about having spoken to her son about the essay and then going back and talking about the process of writing and talking about writing and how do you talk about involving other people in your writing, and she writes that as a footnote to the end of the essay. And I think we all go through different periods of rejection, or whether it's in, you know, your career in terms of, you know, day jobs is obviously the famous phrase that's associated with writers, whether it's to do with writing or creative practice or romance or friendship or family or whatever it is. And I think there's just something that is really kind of heartening and very open, I think, in the essay. And I certainly found it a really kind of encouraging read, and I think certainly writers, I think rejection is something that people talk about all the time, and I think the more that you kind of read about it, it's always a good moment to reset and to get a sense of, oh, this is something that everyone has, and you just have to pick yourself up and get on with the next thing that you're doing.
It's such a strange thing, isn't it? Because you're right, there's so many, if you are a writer, or if you know most, you'll have experienced quite a lot of rejection at various points, unless you're incredibly and hugely lucky in a level that only, you know, a couple of writers are. Yet it still seems like a sort of slightly taboo subject that people don't really talk about it that much. They don't talk about, and you don't learn about the behind every successful kind of story that's published, article that's published, novel that's written. There's so much rejection sort of holding that up, as it were. And it's interesting then when people open themselves up and write something that's quite intimate in this way.
I think so. I would actually really recommend as well, there's a great podcast with the journalist Hattie Crizell, and she does a podcast called In Writing, and it's very much about the nuts and bolts of writing a lot of the time. It's about, like, you know, what was this first draft and what happened when you went on submission and how did this work. Mm-hmm. But there's a really great episode with Anna Hope, the novelist, and very specifically about rejection and her first novel going on submission and it not getting taken up, which is a really common, it's a really common thing. It happens. And even if you end up getting a book deal, baked into that will be rejections. And I think it's a really interesting thing that people don't talk about. And I think it's because rejection is hard. Like, I think, you know, yes, rejection, even if it's something that, I don't know, you kind of think it was a throwaway thing, you just sent something off for a submission, I think it always stings, but equally, you're the only person really that can kind of move yourself on and press send on the next email or do the next thing. So, but I think talking about it, and the more that you can talk about it or talk to friends about it, is a great thing. I'm very lucky, I have a wonderful, wonderful writers group, and we share all of our rejections as well.
Oh, really?
It's so great, and it's a really, I don't know, there's something about marking it, I think, as well, that also helps, so it doesn't feel like this sort of shameful, dirty secret that you got rejected. Because I think part of the thing about rejection is you always have this paranoia of, you know, oh, I've humiliated myself, I've been blacklisted in some way, I don't know. And there's something about sharing it with other people that really just takes the edge off, and you sort of see it for what it is. And I think that's also something that I'd really recommend. So if you're going through it, whatever it is with, just share it with people. I think it's a cliche, but I think talking to people about it makes such a difference. It will make you realize it's just an email. And I think that's the thing as well, that in this essay there's a real sense of the initial pain of seeing something that you know is a rejection of something that you really wanted, and then going back when it stings a bit less, rereading it again, oh, there's something I can take from it. And there won't always be, but I think, again, yeah, being able to share that and talk about it is really helpful. So definitely I would recommend this essay to anyone, whether you're, you know, have creative pursuits or not. I think it's a really, really beautiful piece of writing.
We've all had rejections. We all need to,
yeah, to
yeah, not to hide them away as little dirty, shameful secrets. Yeah. Arshelle's be back in just a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes. I'm talking to Kathy Thomas about rejection, the pain of it, but also how it's sometimes easier when it's shared and talked about. Next up, Kathy, could you tell me about a book that has made you think about feminism in a new way?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Annie Ernaux, specifically A Girl's Story. I've been reading my way through her work. I haven't read my way through all of it.
There's so much of it. That's the kind of joy, right, with her.
There's so much of it. She's wonderfully prolific. I don't know how she does it. And I think that's one of the things, reading her books. Every book, I think, as well, although thematically and in terms of style, there might be something that's different, I think you can learn a lot from whichever one that you pick up. Mm. And the one specifically that really resonated with me was A Girl's Story. And I mean, I think you could pick up lots of different books by her. Particularly, I think Happening is probably very, very current in terms of topic at the moment around sort of conversations around abortion laws. I think Happening would be a really brilliant book for anyone to pick up and read if you're not familiar with her work. It's quite difficult to stomach. It's about her experience of trying to procure a backstreet abortion in France when they were still illegal. But it's a really, what's the word? I was going to say interesting, and that's a really trite word, I think, to use in this context. It's quite a challenging read, but I think it's really insightful and really eye-opening. And A Girl's Story, by contrast, it's another work of memoir. So if you don't know Annie Ernaux's work, it's predominantly non-fiction, it's sort of creative non-fiction, and she has written a novel as well, which I must admit I haven't read. But A Girl's Story looks back on her time when she was 18, and I think it was 1958, and she went off to work in a summer camp, sort of a kid's summer school, basically, as a teaching assistant. And it was her first time away from home, away from her parents, away from what sounded like quite a kind of cloistered upbringing. And she experiences a really problematic sexual experience within her first few days of being at the site. And what the book does is she talks about the process of how she tries to write about the subject and what she thinks about that now and her framework now for understanding, was that sexual assault? Was it something that I consented to or not? And at the same time, she really tries to place herself in the shoes of what she was like when she was 17 or 18 and what she thought about was happening at the time and her experiences of that. I think there's something really, really generous in the way that she frames the story looking back on what's happened to her. Because I think often when we're talking about, feminism, I think often you feel like you have to hold yourself to a really high standard. I think particularly in a culture where, you know, online discourse is so quick to jump on anything, I think when there's quite a cancel culture is quite prevalent, I think you often feel like you have to have quite a spotless record or something to kind of be able to talk about something in a certain way. And I think what Annie Ernaux does in this book that's really wonderful is she talks about bad things happening to herself, and but also kind of how her own opinions of what she thinks is right or wrong, or own opinions of her self-esteem or confidence, and how that has changed over time. And I think it really acknowledges the fact that as people, yeah, how we behave and what we perceive as having happened to us, or how we perceive our actions, that does change over time with experience, and what we might think looking back on something might be completely different to how we perceived it at the time. And there's a real sense of redemption, I think, in her work, and something really important about taking ownership over experiences and feeling empowered enough to go back and re-examine them and to kind of call them by their name as well. So it's a really powerful read, I think. And again, also it's a very short read, so you can sit down and you can read it in an afternoon. I'd recommend that anyone would. But it's really atmospheric, and I found it really, it's quite an emotional book to kind of read. And there's something that is very optimistic in it, because I think the nature of someone looking back on something and talking about, you know, herself when she, a few years older, when she's off, she goes to London and then she goes to university and then she starts talking about her early writing career. So you see a way out for the young Annie Ernaux that you really want her to have. And I think there's something in that that is really wonderful.
There's something particularly intriguing for me about what she does in so many of her work. I haven't read all of her books, but like you, I've read quite a few now. I mean, there's just so many, and Fitzcarraldo keep bringing them out. So, you know, there's always a new one to read. But I'm always really fascinated and also impressed by the way that she seems to be able to draw a very interesting distinction, I think, that you were getting at just then, about the sort of the young Annie Ernaux, the woman she, or the girl she was, and the kind of woman she is now, and her ability to be both, you're right, sympathetic or sort of empathetic towards herself, but also she never lets herself off. It's not as if she's very candid, she has no problem writing about the sort of most intimate things in her life, but she's very good at kind of creating a sort of level of distance between them and being able to make assessments and judgments, and with a very clear-sighted way that I think you can tell that she's really thinking these things through while she's writing as well. She seems to be kind of, there's a sort of ongoing, or for me, I always feel like there's sort of an ongoing process that she's working through in these books. I don't know if you get that sense.
I think
as well.
So. And I have you read this one, Lucy? Have you read A Girl's Story?
Yes, I remember. Yeah, this one and Happening. And I think The Years as well. Those are the three I've read.
Simple Passion, I'd also really recommend as well.
And I think I read another one. There was one about her father. Which was that? I don't know. That was.
I do know the one you mean, because I was looking it up on my list of for the books by her dad and my. To be read well.
Got a collection of her down here. I don't know. Anyway, and another one that I've read, which is about her dad, which is very good.
Yeah, no, but I completely agree. And I think very much in A Girl's Story, she's really, it does feel like she's working it through as she's writing. And she talks a lot about how she, at times, tried to write this story of what happened to her at different stages in her life and couldn't. And
that's one of the most fascinating things, isn't it? That is a story that's taken a really long time for her to get to, and you get the sense that if she'd written it at any different point in her life, it would have been different.
Yeah,
sort of every time she wrote it, it would be a different, not a different version of events, but the story as she puts it together in this book would be a different story, right?
I think so. And I think that's what's really, I suppose particularly in the framework we're kind of talking about telling stories and fiction and non-fiction and literature, and I think within that framework, it's A Girl's Story is a really brilliant example of the consideration, I think, that goes into writing. And at what moment, you know, she even goes into the detail of talking about at which moment she wanted to start telling the story. Should it start here or should it start here? And I think there's such precision in her writing, and it all really underlines the way in which she's really trying to take ownership over what's happened and how she perceives what's happened to her, and how she sees that sense of what happened, and her sense of self has really kind of changed over time. And I think yeah, it's really powerful, and I think it really sort of shows what you can do with good writing. And I think as well, it's the kind of book that I think it will just resonate with a lot of women, and I'm sure a lot of men as well. But I think particularly, yeah, it feels very powerful, I think. And it really does that thing about taking the specific and making it feel universal. I feel like there are lots of women I know. I feel like everyone has different stories, and I think the way in which that Anya Noh has kind of written this, you can kind of see how different experiences can kind of map alongside that, I think.
Yeah, and she's so her writing is so precise and concise as well, that she manages, I mean, I'm always impressed that she writes these very slim books that have that manage to pack so much into them, and the impact, the power of it, like you're talking about, is so it really sort of hits you, but at the same time, they are these little slim things that you can just digest in an afternoon.
Yeah, they're quite cool in terms of, she is very cool, she's a very cool woman, but I think they're quite cool in terms of like tone as well, for something that is talking about incredibly overly emotional, you know, subject matter. She's actually very kind of calm and precise and measured, and there is something which again perhaps points to the fact that she decided to tell this story at a certain point of time, as I'm sure she's done with all of her other writings. But yeah, there is something that is very,
they're so clear-eyed, right? They're just kind of, she just sees things, and she manages to kind of get that across in the writing so precisely that you sort of never doubt for a second what you're reading. You don't question it. You're just kind of there for the ride with the beautiful writing.
Definitely. Yeah.
And finally today, moving on to our last question, tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you admire.
Yeah, I've decided to talk about Carol Churchill, who probably doesn't need me to put her on a pedestal. I think perhaps coming from a bit of a theatre background, she's very much someone that is talked about and known and loved in those kind of circumstances. But I thought perhaps in a context, it might be something that listeners might not know her work so well. And she...
Yeah, I'm wondering if she is so well known today. I mean, like you say, she's very famous on one level, but I was suddenly thinking, I read her play Top Girls and saw it when I was at university, but I don't think I've really come across her that often since then. So
she's great.
Okay, I need to see more of her work, clearly.
So this is the thing, I think, with Carol Churchill. So she was born in 1938 and she's in her 80s now, and she's still writing. She had a play that was on at the Royal Court, I think, was it a year or 2 years ago? I must admit, with COVID and the hiatus in the theatre industry, that has kind of happened. I think it's about 2 years ago. And the thing about Carol Churchill is, and her first sort of play, I think her first play was staged in, I think it was 1972, and then plays like Top Girl and Fenn and some of those kind of big hitters that you know about, they were sort of staged in the early 80s. So she's kind of risen to prominence from those. But what I think is really exciting about her work is every play really is very different from each other. So Top Girls, okay. I could talk about Top Girls, we could talk about that quite a lot. I think, you know, it's 40 years old, I think, this year. 40 years old? 40 years old.
Yeah, and it will be, won't it?
It is. Like, I think Top Girls is still as relevant today as it was when it was written. So we could talk about that at the end of it. But I think Top Girls is a play, for those of you who don't know it, it is sometimes on the sort of A-level English or drama curriculum in schools, and it is the kind of quite a classic university play. You know, there were productions of it when I was at university, and it is one of her plays that probably gets revived more than others. And Top Girls looks really at capitalism and the female experience, and sort of the question really of like, can you have it all? Can you be a mother and can you have a career? It kind of still looks at those questions really, and it has a very famous opening scene which features lots of women from history who are at a dinner party, and it's very stylized in a very kind of specific way, and it's often productions often do it in a very certain way as well. But the meat of the play really is about two sisters, Joyce and Marlene, and Marlene runs a recruitment agency specifically for women. It's all about, it's kind of Thatcherite Britain, and it's the sort of height of capitalism and getting women into really well-paid, like flashy jobs. And she's kind of, yeah, real sort of career success. And then her sister Joyce, who actually looks after Marlene's daughter, who is there's kind of questions, I think, over her. This is actually something which maybe we should edit out. I was trying to think, how do we frame it? So Joyce looks after Marlene's sister, and Marlene has kind of washed her hands of her to a certain degree. And the play kind of really looks at their relationship and the toll that kind of success, what does that mean and what does that look like? And is Marlene really happy? And there's lots of questions, I think, posed by the play that I think are still very, very relevant, I think, today. And I think particularly, the last scene of that play is such a powerful one. And there's a sort of line that Marlene kind of has about just because people are lazy or frightened, you think I should get them jobs. There's this kind of, which I think is the kind of discourse that is, you know, cropping up again at the moment in politics and society, and it's really interesting. But Top Girls is that is one play, and then some of our other plays like Far Away is a sort of dystopian play in three acts, and it's that came out in about 2000, I think, and it's a short play. I think it's about 50 minutes, and like the whole world is at war with the weather and with each other, and it's this incredibly powerful, quite terrifying force of drama, and it's absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. Her play A Number was about cloning. Fen is a really quite a difficult claustrophobic look at kind of small rural community life, but some of her more recent plays as well are really, really cracking. Like she wrote a play called Escape to Lone, which was at the Royal Court a couple of years ago, which kind of looks at sort of four older suburban women, and it's kind of looking, there's a famous line which sort of says terrible rage, and it's kind of looking at this kind of inner turmoil versus the kind of peacefulness and tranquility of this, you know, suburban setting. And everything that she does is really, really different, and that's what I think is really remarkable about her, is that she hasn't been, I think what sometimes can happen is if one person is good at one thing, that's what they end up getting commissioned to do a lot, or that's what people want from them, so they end up kind of reproducing that kind of work. And somehow Carol Churchill has managed to do different things at every single stage of her career. And there are things like, you can look at her on a page, like it's, you know, people pastiche it quite a lot in sort of student theatre. You can look at what a Carol Churchill play like looks like on a page. Her way of setting out dialogue is very very specific, and has been very sort of groundbreaking in what a play might look like on paper. But at the same time, I think, the content of her work really, really sort of varies. And like there was a play, Light Shining in Buckinghamshire, which is about the English Civil War, which had a revival at the National a couple of years ago. And it's like absolutely mind-blowing if you've seen that versus if you've seen Top Girls or A Number. It's all really different. And I think there's something that is incredible, incredibly sort of, I don't know, remarkable, I think, about her sense of ambition.
Do you have any sense of how she manages to do that? Like you were saying, it's kind of rare that you find someone. Like I'm always, really interested, I think, because many people are writers who tend to do something radically different each time, right? Because in a sense, many writers sort of almost go back to the same thing over and over again. It might be subtly different, and there's a joy in that as well. But people who tend to be able to sort of almost jettison what's come before and do something new, that seems such a, it seems such a huge task to set yourself. And I'm always intrigued to work out what it is about that particular writer or person. I mean, do you have any sense? Is this a terribly tricky question to ask?
It is really tricky. But what one thing that I think is really interesting is she's very rarely, maybe pitch and told is the wrong word, but she's very rarely kind of pinned down as a woman playwright. And I think theatre is an industry that I think is, I think it is behind kind of literary fiction in terms of, it was only in, was it 2006 or 2008? I think the first play by a woman was on the main stage, the Olivier at the National. Like theatre, there is not equal representation in all sorts of ways, frankly, in theatre, but in terms of gender parity, that is not the case in theatre on main stages in the UK. I can't speak for Ireland, but certainly in kind of London main stages, that is really not the case. And so and what is interesting is some other playwrights who've been making work around the same time as Carol Churchill, like, and particularly in the 80s, there's a real explosion of some really interesting sort of plays, and say 80s and 90s plays by some really brilliant female dramatists. And I don't know whether it's partly because of some of the content of their work, like, but I think often some of those playwrights have been, they've always got the moniker, they're a female playwright, whereas I think Carol Churchill has somehow managed to avoid that. And I wonder if that is what has given her a bit more freedom perhaps over what she's been doing. But I mean, also it might simply be, I know that I believe she's quite kind of private, she doesn't do much in the way of publicity, she's famously never does interviews, she kind of keeps to herself. And I think there, and she also, the way that a lot of playwrights make money is you write for TV, you write for film, that's how you do it. There's not really any money in theatre. And I think there is something that is very kind of purist, I think, in that Carol Churchill, she writes for theatre and she gets on with it and she does what she wants. And then she kind of, I believe, kind of emerges with the play, and then she sends it to the Royal Court, she sends it to whichever theatre. And I think there is something about her kind of focus that I think must be to do with it. But I wonder if that is also tied into the fact that she, I don't think has been kind of put in a certain box, I think, in terms of, being a woman writer. I wonder if that has perhaps created more opportunities, or maybe she has kind of shied away from that and kind of used that to her advantage in a certain way.
And has she been a particular inspiration, would you say, to your own playwriting? Or is there...
Well, it's interesting. That's a tricky question. I mean, I think I wish I was someone who was so sort of formally inventive and had such a range in sort of tone and ideas. I wonder, will I end up being someone who, you know, and lots of actors do it where they write, they have similar sort of questions or themes they're interested in, and they do that. And they kind of work on those a lot. And that's, I think, the same, whether it's theatre, whether it's novels, whichever art form it is. And I wonder whether I will be that. I don't know. I certainly don't think I have the sort of, currently I do not have the sort of scale that I think Cara Churchill has.
Yes, all right, you've got plenty of time though. That's the great thing about her, is that you can look and see this kind of, you know, very, very long career, right?
Well, I think so. And I think actually what is interesting as well is, you know, she was writing a lot in the kind of 70s, and some of those plays are, they do not have the stature perhaps of sort of Top Girls or Fenn or The Skranker or Love, you know, some of her sort of later works. And so I think there is that thing, and perhaps, you know, that's an element of I think the fact that now we're in such a digitized world, everything that we do is online, all of your early writing, even if you published something a long time ago that you think, oh, I don't love that, you know, that will be out there somewhere. So I think perhaps being in a world that was not everything was online, I think maybe gave a bit more of a starting point to kind of experiment without feeling quite so kind of watched about everything that you're doing. But I mean, God, I'd love to be like Carol Church. I don't know how she does it. It's really amazing. But I think, I imagine as well, there is something about theatre, which I actually do think is the same to a degree in writing literature, in writing prose. But I think theatre is such a, by its nature, a collaborative art form. And I imagine that if there's certain directors or certain people that she's collaborating with, that probably shapes work in certain ways as well. Or I also think you probably have people at an earlier stage to kind of bounce ideas around with, whereas I think with kind of writing prose, you always feel the need to kind of get it on the page first before you can sort of have those kind of discussions in a certain way.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Cathy. I've really enjoyed this conversation. You've introduced us to lots of wonderful things. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone else, for listening. Our Shelves is brought to you by the team of Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Cathy Thomas. And tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.